Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the OIES China Energy Program. My name is Anders Hobey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, and I'm joined today by Philip Andrews Speed, who is also a Senior Research Fellow with the OIES China Energy Research Program. Today, we'll be speaking about China's impressive growth trajectory in the field of nuclear power. Philip, welcome back. It's good to have you.
And good to be with you, Anders.
To kick us off, we often hear about China being the biggest in the world in various different energy fields, but that's not yet the case for nuclear energy. Could you help paint us the picture of China's nuclear build-out, and how does it compare with the leaders so far up to the present in nuclear power?
Yes, correct. China's fleet of civil nuclear power plants is not the largest in the world, but it is the fastest growing. At the end of 2023, the total installed capacity in China of nuclear power was about 53 gigawatts. That's behind the US that has 95 gigawatts, and France with 61 gigawatts. But China has more than 27 gigawatts under construction and another 48 gigawatts planned. So by 2028-29, the capacity should reach 80 gigawatts, and by 2035, if all goes to plan, maybe 130 gigawatts.
So basically, China will cross over and become the largest in terms of total nuclear capacity around 2030 or 2030s-ish. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. And it will still be growing.
Now, what's the motivation for this rapid buildup? And I would say rapid because even though it's going to take a while to surpass, the amount under construction is really stupendous. What has been the historic motivation and what's the motivation now?
Well, going back to the 1970s, after they'd sort of got the military nuclear program going, the original motivation for civil nuclear power was energy security, especially relating to electricity supplies, because with the growing economy, there were electricity shortages. If we move forward to this century, the need to reduce dependence on coal for power generation and thus suppress air pollution, and then more recently carbon emissions from thermal power stations, has become an increasingly important priority.
So in a lot of the other energy fields, China has also become a technology leader. What can you tell us about China's nuclear energy technology? First of all, is it a homegrown technology? And how does its technology compare to what exists in the United States, Europe, or the rest of Asia, where there are a number of other nuclear leading countries?
Well, aside from one of the very first plants that was built in China that was of Chinese design, most reactors, until very recently, have drawn on designs from France, Canada, and Russia, and more recently, United States, and in some cases have been built by companies from these countries. However, Chinese engineers have been building on this international cooperation to produce the new design, the Hualong 1 reactor, which is entirely of Chinese design, and nearly all the components are made in China. So when it comes to conventional pressurized water reactors, then China is up there with the leaders.
And China is working on many of the newer nuclear technologies. We hear a lot about small nuclear reactors, Gen 4 reactors, nuclear fusion. First of all, maybe can you just briefly say what are those, and are you optimistic in general about those technologies, and what is China doing in that field?
Well, small modular reactors is a term that means anything that is a lot smaller than the current gigawatt size. The biggest is the Rolls-Royce at 450 megawatts, but they can go down to 30 megawatts. And they can be of different design, though the quickest off the block is probably going to be, again, pressurized water reactors. Generation 4 reactors use different technologies and, in many cases, different fuels. Whilst the original ideas go back to the 1950s, they're being designed and tested now, but none are in operation. And nuclear fusion has been a dream for the last 70 years. Now, China is working all of these. And I recall when I first worked with the Institute of Nuclear Energy Technology of Tsinghua University in 1998, they proudly told me that they were building an experimental pebble bed reactor in Changping, north of Beijing. And by 2021, a 200 megawatt demonstration, what is now called a high temperature gas cooled reactor, was completed in Shandong. So this 25 years of work has proved good. And, you know, this is one of the first operating high temperature gas cooled reactors in the world. In addition, China's working on molten salt and fast neutron reactors, district heating reactors, floating nuclear power plants, as well as nuclear fusion. So it's really right up there with the rest of the world, though a lot of these technologies have yet to come onto the market.
Now, Philip, you write that nuclear energy in China faces some significant challenges. And some of those challenges are the same everywhere, and some of them are actually quite different or possibly unique in China. One of the ones that you mentioned is imported nuclear fuel. Where does China get its nuclear fuel, and what's its plan for the future?
Well, China's domestic reserves of uranium are geologically limited, and so it's heavily dependent on imported fuels. The current strategy is that one third of the uranium requirements will be from domestic sources, one third through trade imports, and one third from overseas mining. Now, China imports uranium from a number of countries, such as Kazakhstan, Namibia, Niger, Uzbekistan, Canada, and Australia. But at the same time, it has equity joint ventures in uranium mines in Kazakhstan, Namibia, Niger, and Uzbekistan. So you can see this strategy starting to play out. More importantly, potentially, it's building two facilities for reprocessing spent fuel from nuclear power plants into uranium and plutonium. And they are in the construction in Gansu province. Once operational, these plants will enhance China's security of supply for uranium and plutonium for nuclear power plants.
So what about the other challenges? It must be an immense difficulty in scaling up the nuclear fleet. Other countries, of course, have faced the same challenge just with building nowadays a single reactor. What about trying to build nuclear plants at a rate that's potentially double that any country ever experienced in the past? Is that a particular challenge for China?
Yes, you're right. I mean, the rate of construction is even greater than that in the United States in its heyday of the 1970s and 80s. So it is very rapid. And the main challenge, as one might expect, relates to safety. And this has two main aspects. First is, can the National Nuclear Safety Administration effectively regulate this large and rapidly expanding fleet of power stations? Not only the power stations themselves, but the vast supply chain. And we've seen supply chain challenges in Korea, and we've seen and in France, and let alone the power stations themselves, we've seen problems in Japan. Second, and I think one might argue this is a peculiarly East Asian problem as well, you know, can the workforce for the construction, operation, and maintenance of these reactors continue to grow, and that would be a problem anywhere, and maintain the necessary levels of vigilance? And one aspect of this vigilance is not just pure vigilance, but the willingness to report faults upwards to management and to challenge management. And this has certainly been a problem in South Korea, where there were problems and they were just not reported upwards, either to management or to the regulator. So I think there are real problems here in just producing the number of skilled workers and operators and constructors to keep supplying this vast and growing industry. The second challenge relates to public opinion. I mean, in recent years, surveys done by Chinese academics show that in general, Chinese citizens appear to be supportive of nuclear power. But as one might expect, those living near planned reactors tend to be more cautious. And as a result, we've seen a greater openness from and the regulator, the power companies and the local governments to get more engaged with local communities and to explain the benefits, the pricing and the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So those are two issues that I think are most challenging, as they are in every other country with large fleets.
And a part of that, obviously, is safety. There haven't been any major nuclear incidents in China. What can you tell us about safety in general in China, other than the challenges of maintaining safety in the future?
Well, officially, there have been no incidents greater than level 2 on the IEA's scale of accidents. The top level is 7, like Fukushima. And one can believe that. However, I think there are two sort of problems. If one goes on to the sort of some of the gossip, Chinese gossip sites, one hears about overworked operating staff in reactors that are not getting enough holiday or enough time off and are tired, etc. That's one sort of theme. And the other came up 2 or 3 years ago. There was an incident in a plant in Guangdong, and there wasn't much transparency. And the partner was trying to find out, the foreign partner, what was going on. And the regulator and the company were really not being very open. So I think transparency is an issue.
Now, initially, China was planning to build reactors both on the coast and also inland. But after Fukushima, that kind of got postponed or put on the shelf, at least temporarily. What's the situation now with inland reactors, and why is that important?
Well, to date, all of China's operating power plants lie along the coast, as do those under construction, so that any wastewater coming out goes into the sea. And if there's an accident, as in Fukushima, the pollution goes into the sea, not into fresh waters. Now, before the Fukushima accident in 2011, there were a number of planned reactors for inland areas of China. These plans were suspended immediately after the Fukushima accident because of concerns over the risk to fresh water, that is, big lakes and rivers on which China depends for irrigation, for drinking water, for fisheries, etc., etc. To date, no approvals have been given for the construction of reactors inland. However, there are still some listed as being planned, and I think that will be a big decision if they decide to allow them to go ahead. And that, I think, would be contentious and would draw public resistance not only near the sites, but maybe from wider around China. So let's see. There's no sign that they're being approved yet.
How does China pay for these reactors? It's no surprise that China is building a huge amount of capacity, but nuclear is expensive globally, at least outside of China. So what's the economic motivation here?
Well, the details of the costs and revenues are not publicly available, but I think we can assume that a combination of low input costs, workers' costs and energy, economies of scale, because everything is so huge, and certain models are built many times, that leads to short construction time. So all of these things together, we must assume, means that China's construction costs are significantly lower than those in Europe and the US. Now, for the companies that build and operate these plants, there is no preferentially high tariff for them. In fact, it's a little bit lower than the standard benchmark tariff for coal. However, the nuclear power plants receive preferential dispatch. And of course, that is key, so that assuming they are not under maintenance, they can operate and dispatch the whole time.
It's an interesting vicious circle when a reactor takes more than a decade to build, then by the time it's constructed, some of the designs are no longer the latest design, and some of the parts that it was designed for might no longer be available. That wouldn't be the case when the reactors are able to be completed and they're quite modular to begin with. You mentioned that one of the motivations for China's nuclear power is to mitigate the carbon emissions of the power sector. To what extent will nuclear power really assist in China's net zero emissions plans? What percentage of the power sector will it make up if these plans are realized?
Well, nuclear power today accounts for about 5% of China's electricity mix and about 2.5% of primary energy consumption. So it's significant, but it's not large. Now, the optimistic projections see installed nuclear capacity rising to maybe 300 gigawatts or more by 2050. This would allow nuclear to provide maybe 16 to 20% of electricity supply, which would really start to be significant. And you put that together with wind and hydro and solar, and you have a lot of low carbon electricity. Of course, the issue is, will they keep building to that scale? And I think that depends on whether they have an accident, that's higher than level two on the IAEA's scale. If there is a serious or moderately serious accident, to what extent would that put public opinion against nuclear power and mean they stop or at least pause the nuclear power program? But what we're seeing in Japan is that, 12, 13 years after the accident, the country is moving ahead, restarting reactors, and maybe going ahead and building more.
So it could be very significant, but a lot of uncertainty.
Yes, absolutely.
Chinese companies have been very active up to the present in building large infrastructure projects outside of China, especially along the Belt and Road. And that includes nuclear. But you write in your second article that this could be changing. Tell me more about that. Why is it that nuclear power construction abroad might be slowing for Chinese firms?
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, Chinese oil companies have been investing overseas for 30 years. The hydroelectricity companies have been building dams abroad for even longer. And more recently, power companies have been building thermal and renewable power capacity, especially in developing countries. The nuclear industry for China has been much slower moving overseas. The only reactors in operation overseas are in Pakistan, and this is slightly special because China has a long-standing, close strategic and economic relationship with Pakistan. One Chinese company, CGN, is an investment partner in the United Kingdom's Hinkley Point C reactor, which is still under construction after 10 years or so. Now, the company had hoped to construct a Hualong reactor in the UK at the Bradwell site. But this seems unlikely now due to deteriorating relations between the UK and China. Nevertheless, the UK Office of Nuclear Regulation has given generic design approval for the Hualong 1 design, which is a good sort of signpost for other countries should they wish to take on this design. Now, Chinese companies have a number of agreements of different types with other companies and other countries around the world, but none seem to be moving forwards at the moment. In some cases, national governments are turning away from China. Romania, for example, has switched from China to the US, and Argentina's new president threatens to cancel plans for new reactors to be built by China. Also, I think the Chinese companies are pretty busy at home, and so there's not a lot of spare capacity or energy, as it were, to do much overseas, despite an initial promise to build huge numbers of reactors along the Belt and Road.
That's the status update. And you touched a little bit on the political element there of suspicion regarding Chinese investments. But at the biggest and broadest level, how do investments in overseas nuclear reactors, how do they affect relations between countries or maybe bind countries together in ways that other infrastructure investments don't necessarily do?
Well, a national nuclear power program requires, by the government and the relevant companies, a commitment of at least 100 years, from the initial decision, planning and construction, through 40 to maybe 60 years of operation to final decommissioning. So a foreign nuclear vendor that enters a country that is embarking on a nuclear program for the first time has the opportunity to build a decades-long relationship between the respective companies and between their governments. So this is potentially a long-term political link and gives potentially a lever to one party or the other or both.
in that regard, you compare and contrast Russia and China in terms of their current and future nuclear exports. How do their strategies differ, maybe up until the present and then going forward?
Russia has taken a much more aggressive and strategic approach to nuclear power export than has China. Post-Soviet Russia has built or is building reactors in eight countries, six of which are not former Warsaw Pact members: Bangladesh, China, Egypt, India, Iran, and Turkey. And like China, Russia has signed agreements with many other countries. But again, a number of these governments have terminated Russian involvement, particularly in the last 2 or 3 years. Behind this strategic approach, Russia has offered very generous terms to its customers, and this includes providing low-interest loans, a lot of training, and taking back spent fuel. In the case of Turkey, the plant is actually under a build-own-operate arrangement, whereby the Russians will be in charge of everything. And that's actually proved very contentious politically, not for the government, but among other people in Turkey. In contrast, Chinese companies have been taking a more gradual and commercial approach, with the exception of Pakistan. And as I mentioned, not least because they're pretty busy constructing new reactors back in China. And I think China, through other elements of its Belt and Road initiative, has other ways to, as it were, bind in countries to its strategic view.
And as we start to wrap up here, what is the potential impact of these overseas nuclear investments by both Russia and China on climate? Do these overseas building programs really have the potential to create a great deal of reduction in global carbon emissions?
Looking forward 20 years or so, you know, I expect companies from both Russia and China to continue building reactors overseas, though possibly at a slower rate than some might have expected a few years ago. And as we said, many potential clients may be reluctant to choose Russian reactors, at least in the next few years. And maybe Russia's ability to provide generous loans may diminish as a result of its commitments elsewhere, not least in Ukraine. For Chinese vendors, as I mentioned, their overseas activities are likely to continue to be constrained by their hefty construction program back at home and by a more commercial outlook. So whilst nuclear power companies from both China and Russia will certainly be able to help individual countries by building low carbon power generation capacity in the form of nuclear power, I think at the global scale, this is not likely to be significant, at least not in the coming 2 decades.
Okay, that's all the time we have for today. Philip, I'd like to thank you for joining, and I'd also like to thank our audience. Thank you for listening, and we hope you've appreciated the discussion today. We welcome your feedback and thoughts and look forward to our next discussion and hope you'll join us next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.